You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
We are back in the book of Revelation tonight. Very exciting. Final book in our Bibles about the final events of human history. All right, so this book, Revelation, final book in our Bibles. It's about the end of this world as we know it and what comes next. Last week we started this book, we saw old Apostle John, 95 AD. He's been exiled to a labor camp on Patmos, an island off the coast of modern-day Turkey. And John, he's probably in his 80s, maybe in his 90s by now. And as he's spending time with God, we saw he was interrupted by the appearance of Jesus Christ, the glorified Christ. He sees Jesus standing among these seven lampstands. He starts piling them up images of what the glorified, risen Christ looked like. It's, you know, like snow, but like fire, and his eyes and his feet were glowing like metal, and his voice was like many waters, and his mouth, there was like this sword stabbing out of his mouth, and he's holding stars in his hand, and his face was like the sun. Oh! And so John just falls over. Like, this is so overwhelming. Jesus kneels down, and he gives him a message. And he tells him, he says, I want you to write something for me, John. He's still got some work for old John to do. He says, I want you to write what you've seen. That's the vision of Revelation 1. We covered that last week. You can pick up the audio if you want. He also says, I want you to write what is now and what will take place later. Now, what will take place later? This is a nice little outline for the book of Revelation. What will take place later? These would be all those prophecies about the end of the world and what comes next that Revelation is so famous for. That's chapters 4 through 22. But what we get in chapters 2 and 3 is a message for seven different churches, seven different Christian communities that existed in John's day. In fact, one of them, the very first one, the one we'll look at tonight, the city of Ephesus, John actually spent several decades at that church. He led in that church for many years leading up to his exile. And so he's going to have a message to these churches. And if we want to see where this is, here's kind of a map of the Eastern Hemisphere. If you zoom in on what we call Turkey, they called Asia or Asia Minor. And the western coast of Turkey, John is on this little island called Patmos here. He's been exiled there. He's not that far from where he actually spent many years of his life. He lived at Ephesus, which was a major port city of that day. He's going to write a letter to these seven churches. And you can see these numbers go clockwise. There was actually a road that connected these, Ephesus to Smyrna to Pergamum and then around to Thyatira. The messenger would have shown up with the letter from John and would have taken him to the first church. They probably would have made their own copy. He would have taken them to the next church. They would have made their own copy. And he would have delivered them to church after church and read them to these churches. And so we're going to see the pattern that John follows is the order that the messenger would have traveled in for delivering these messages. Jesus has a message for these churches. And these messages, they're all in chapters 2 and 3. We're not going to be able to look at all of them. You're going to have to read some on your own. Tonight, we'll just look at the first one. Next week, we'll look at another one or two from chapter 3. But the message follows a predictable pattern. First, it says the audience, and they all start this way. Write this letter to the angel of the church in blank this week, Ephesus. Now, this angel business is a little confusing. Remember last week, Jesus holds the seven stars in his hand? Those represent the angels of the churches. What is this angel? Some people think this is like, the word angel also means messenger. So some people think, write this to the messenger that's going to go to Ephesus. Others say, this may be the pastor of the church at Ephesus. And Jesus is kind of writing a message to him to be disseminated to the rest of the church. A third theory is this is actually an angel. You know, Jesus taught we have guardian angels, Matthew 18. And it looks like, you know, we have angels sort of associated with us throughout our lives. Looks like maybe there's angels associated with churches as well. Maybe whole groups of angels, but maybe one that's sort of central there. And so when, you know, regardless of what this is, I kind of lean toward it's an actual angel. I don't think it's that important. The point is, the one he's writing to kind of represents the spirit, like the character of this church. And when he addresses this angel, he's really addressing the church as a whole and characteristics of that church as a whole. It's kind of funny to think that our church may have an angel associated with it. I kind of wonder what that angel would be like, the angel of Dwell. But Tonight we'll read a letter to the angel of the church in Ephesus. The very next step in this, he says, to the angel of the church at Ephesus, this is from, and then Jesus describes himself, and he always describes himself in some language, some aspects of the vision from Revelation chapter 1. Is there certain aspects of that vision that are particularly relevant for this church? Third, there's some encouragement from Jesus. Five of these churches, Jesus has something good to say about that church, something he likes about that church. And so he's going to give them some positive feedback. You're doing this well. After that, Jesus is going to give some areas for improvement. Five of these churches have areas for improvement. You're like, wait, there's seven churches. Yeah, two of them he has only good things to say. Two of them he has only bad things to say. Three of them, it's a mixed bag. He has some good and some bad to say. And so the encouragement and the areas for improvement come next. And this would be pretty useful to get, actually. You know, back before I was a Bible teacher, I had a career in software engineering. And me and our sales guy, we used to show up at companies for meetings with like their chief technology officer. And we would just sit down and we'd be like, just tell us, what are you doing? What are you using? He'd kind of go through all their different systems. And we would kind of listen, ask questions, and then we would give him some feedback. We'd say, this part is really good. This part could use some work. And then we would say, you want to pay us to help? And sometimes they would, sometimes they wouldn't. But regardless, it was a useful exercise to have some. It's hard to get a sort of a clear perspective when you're kind of down there in it, to have somebody come in from the outside who's got some expertise. That's helpful. And Jesus is like the gold standard of that. He's coming in and he's saying, I have a direct message for you. Here's what I think about what you're doing. Here's some good things. Here's some things that are not so good. We're gonna have both of these tonight for the church at Ephesus. He then gives a warning about how, you know, at least for the people that have got problems that need to be fixed. And then there's a call to listen. And it always says something like, he who has an ear or she who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And so on the one hand, this is a letter to all the churches. Every one of the churches he's writing to could read the message to Ephesus and could probably learn a little something from that. Anyone in any of those churches could listen and hear what Jesus might have to say. And so this would apply to us as well. You know, even though this is a specific message for Ephesus, we should think, is there anything here that applies to us? Is there anything here that applies to me? And this was something Jesus said while he was alive as well, when he would tell parables and he says, whoever has an ear to hear, let him hear. And so the same thing applies to you tonight. Do you have an ear to hear? You only need one, okay? One ear. Do you have a single ear to hear what the Holy Spirit is saying? And I believe Jesus has something to say to us tonight. If you're willing to listen, he's got something to say to you. And so we should come into this study with an open heart, a willingness to hear. Finally, he gives a promise to the one who overcomes, the one who is victorious, I will ... And there's a promise usually related to the future or heaven. And the first church he writes to is the church at Ephesus. Write this letter to the angel of the church in Ephesus, Revelation chapter 2, verse 1. The church at Ephesus, one of the largest cities in the Roman Empire, estimates put it at the third or fourth largest. Strabo, the ancient historian geographer from the first century, says this was second in importance only to Rome. You can see here the massive temple to Artemis, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And this is actually the picture from the game Seven Wonders. Ephesus is one of the kingdoms there, or whatever they call them. And so this temple to Artemis, this temple at Ephesus, was huge, was a huge tourist attraction. They made a lot of money off this. In fact, when Paul came there and started telling people about Jesus and that gods made with human hands are no gods at all, the idol makers started getting pretty angry. He was cutting into their bottom line. So this temple to Ephesus, they have found temple at Ephesus to Artemis. Artemis was a major deity. She was a fertility goddess, as you can see from this statue of Artemis that is actually at the museum to Ephesus. You can tell she's a fertility goddess just from the way this statue is made. It's funny listening to archaeologists talk about what are the things coming off the front of her body. They're like, these would be eggs or bull testicles. Yeah, maybe. Definitely a fertility goddess, though, that they worshipped for fertility, both having babies as well as crops. Fertility for their harvest. This is all related to wealth. Of course, the temple to Ephesus is not looking too good today. Here's all that's left of it. This is the stadium. This is the amphitheater at Ephesus. It could seat tens of thousands of people. You can still see it today. It's a picture I took when I was there a couple years back. There's a scene in the book of Acts, chapter 19, that takes place in this very amphitheater. The church at Ephesus, one of the most important churches, maybe the most important church in the New Testament. We probably have more written about and to the church at Ephesus than any other church, including the church at Jerusalem. You know, the Apostle Paul spent 3 years there, we read in Acts chapter 19. 3 years. It's the longest he spent anywhere in the book of Acts, as far as church planting goes. 3 years here at Ephesus. And not only that, not only did he plant this church, he visited it multiple times afterward. He sent Priscilla and Aquila there to be there when he wasn't there. He sent his top dude, Timothy, there. The epistles, 1st and 2nd Timothy, those are written to Timothy while he's at Ephesus. Not only that, after Timothy left, the Apostle John spent, according to history, according to tradition, several decades of his life here working at and leading in the church at Ephesus. This is a very, very important church. This is like a who's who of Christians in the New Testament were the leaders of this church. Got a lot written to it, a lot written about this church. And Jesus says to the church at Ephesus, this is the message from the one who holds the 7 stars in his right hand, the one who walks among the 7 gold lampstands. You know, Jesus is like, these churches, I've got them. I've got him in my hand. These churches, I'm not distant. I'm right in there among the churches. You know, sometimes it feels like things in this church are completely out of control. We feel so alone. And Jesus says, no, that's not true at all. I've got you in my hand. I'm right there in and among you. Nobody has to report to Jesus what's happening in our church, in our home churches, in your life. He's right there in and among the churches. He sees what's going on. He sees a lot more than the externals too. He sees the heart. He sees the unseen, the hidden world, the spiritual dimension. And then he comes in with some encouragement. He says, I know all the things you do. I've seen your hard work, your patient endurance. You've patiently suffered for me without quitting. And so what does he see here? He sees you guys are doing a lot. You're working hard. And some people might think Jesus would be like, whoa, don't do so much. But no, it's good to be busy serving God. It's good to be busy serving Christ. He's our Lord. He's our master. We're the servants. And so if you went to this church, you would just see people doing stuff all over the place. There's stuff happening multiple nights of the week, maybe every night of the week, during the day. People are spending time with God. People are doing so much for God in this church. And Jesus says, that's good. They're hanging in there. They're patient despite suffering. Jesus is not like, well, you know, you're suffering. You must be doing something wrong. He says, no, this is normal. It's hard. Life is hard. Serving God is hard. And so you don't always see results. It's not just quick, quick, quick. We're gonna have to hang in there even when we don't see anything. We're gonna have to be patient. We're gonna have to endure. How are we doing in these areas? Working hard, doing a lot. How are we doing in these areas? Hanging in there, patient, despite suffering. These are meant to be encouragement for them. And I think there's some encouragement for us here. He also says, I know you don't tolerate evil people. You've examined the claims of those who say they are apostles but are not. You've discovered they're liars. And you hate the evil deeds of the Nicolaitans, just as I do. That was a sect. It was a group of false teachers. It's not actually clear what they taught, but it was false. And it comes up again later in this chapter. Some of the other churches had not resisted the teachings of the Nicolaitans. Jesus doesn't say, I hate the Nicolaitans, but he says, I hate what they do. I hate their teaching, and I hate their actions. He loves them, and he wants them to be liberated from the lies that they're stuck in. And so what else does he say about the church at Ephesus? He says, you guys are learning a lot. You guys are a church about learning. You got classes going all the time. Remember when Paul was there, he would rent out the lecture hall of Tyrannus, and he would lecture every single day for several years, teaching, teaching, teaching. This was a powerful teaching church. These guys would have known their Bibles. They would have known, you know, writings from other Christians. They would have been well acquainted with proper teaching. They also did not tolerate false teachers. You know, Paul predicted in Acts 20, when he visited this church again, he gave a speech to the leaders of this church, and he said, from among you, false teachers will arise. You gotta be on the watch for these wolves in sheep's clothing. And they were. He warns Timothy, watch out. I left you there so you could set in order the teaching and teach people, tell people not to teach this and not to teach that. And so they didn't tolerate false teachers. These guys were hardworking. They were tough. They were patient. They endured suffering. They were a learning church. They were discerning truth. They ferreted out false teaching and they taught what was right. Jesus has a lot of good things to say about this church. And I think he would have a lot of good things to say about our church in this area. You know, so far, these guys are pulling straight A's. This report card looks awesome. And it would be great if it just stopped here, right? It would be great if this is all he had to say. However, that's not all he has to say to this church. Jesus said, you've got so many good things going for you, and I'm really pleased with those. But there's one thing that is breaking my heart. And if this one thing doesn't get fixed, all those other things really don't matter. It doesn't matter all the things that you do and all the things that you know and all the things that you endure and all the false teaching you refute. And he comes in with the area for improvement. And he says, but I have this complaint against you. You have left your first love. What does he mean? You have left your first love. Is he saying you don't love God like you did at first? Is he saying you don't love one another like you did at first? Some of our Bibles take it both ways. Some of it leave it sort of ambiguous, like this here. I'm inclined to take it both ways. Here's what Jesus says when someone says, what's the greatest commandment? He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And a second is equally important. Love your neighbor as yourself. The Bible links these two together. If there's a problem with our love for other people, it means there's a problem in our love for God. It shows the root of the problem. You know, in 1 Corinthians 13, Paul speaks to the Corinthian church and he says, you know, if I could speak all the languages of earth and of angels, but didn't love others, I would be only a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. So important. He says, if I had the gift of prophecy and possessed all knowledge, but I didn't love others, I would be nothing. If I don't love, it doesn't matter what I know. It doesn't matter what I can speak. I would be so annoying, like a clanging gong, bong, bong, bong. I would be nothing, he says. He says, if I gave everything I have to the poor and even sacrificed my body, I could boast about it. You could certainly feel proud about that. But if I didn't love others, I would have gained nothing. I'd be so annoying, and I would be nothing, and I would have gained nothing. Love is so important. Love is central to everything that we do. And that's his message to the Ephesian church. He says, you guys have had an all-star cast of leaders here, and you've had the best teaching, and you do so much, and you work so hard, and you refute false doctrine, and you're so tough, but you got a love problem. You're lacking in love, Jesus says. What does first love look like? You know, if you see people that are first in love, it's like, it's almost like a drug, you know? They kind of do, like I think engagement photos might be like the pinnacle of this. Here's some, you know, you look up engagement photos and it's like, oh, let's do the piggyback thing on a beach. Oh, now let's make the heart with our hands and put our foreheads together. Oh, yeah, silhouette with the sunset. Oh, let's do the Titanic thing. I'm flying, Jack, I'm flying. Okay, it's really sweet, but like it's not the thing you would do at any other point in your life. It's like you're high on love here. These can get kind of weird, like let's do the water one, babe. My love for you is like water. Or our love has been written in the stars. I don't know what, I can't even narrate this one here. Some kind of a mermaid thing. And this one is just straight out of the 80s. Wow. Just remember, when you're getting engagement photos, people have to look at these things. Just keep that in mind. First love And you know, he's drawing this analogy of first love. You see this in new believers sometimes, where they're, you know, the message of the Bible is, we're God's enemies. We deserve hell. And Jesus died on the cross for me. Jesus loved me while I was still his enemy. And like, you can hear that message and it's like, blah, blah, blah. But when it finally hits, and when you finally meet Christ in a personal way, his love floods into your heart, Paul says in Romans 5. And it's so powerful. It feels like, for me, it felt like this overwhelming drug. I would just break down in tears because I felt so much love from him as a new believer. And the love for one another, you just see that overflowing as well. Like, I remember I just was like so lonely and so hopeless. And then I'm in contact with the other people. They get it. They know God as well in a personal way, and they have his love dwelling in their heart. And there's just like a connection. And I was so excited and I was so happy, especially coming from where I was to where I was at that point. And yet that can then fade. And you want to tell people about it. And you want to spend time with God. But that can start to cool at a point. You know, think about a relationship that's lost its love. What would a loveless relationship look like? You know, it might be, you know, you might be putting the bare minimum into this relationship. You might be sort of avoiding the other person. You're definitely not initiating with them. It's very, very passive a lot of times. There's a lack of gratitude, a lack of affection, a lack of expressed affirmation in this relationship. You know, I've been in relationships like these that like was exciting, like romantic, or they were exciting and then they just weren't. And you start thinking, should I still even be in this relationship? Is this something where I need to, is this like something I need to fight for, or is this something God's saying to move on from? You know, what might cause the decline in that relationship? Honestly, a lot of the things that characterize that relationship might also cause its decline. Passivity, lack of gratitude, lack of affirmation, lack of expression, lack of time spent, bare minimum. It's hard to tell, do the actions cause the cooling of the relationship, or does the cooling of the relationship cause the cooling on the actions? Think about this. You've probably seen this before. This is the imagery that Jesus is drawing on here when he speaks to the church at Ephesus. Your love for me, you're losing it. You don't have the love that you had at first. You've left. It's not you've lost it. Lost it is something that can kind of accidentally happen. No, it's just like a drifting away. You've left. The good news is you can come back. You can come back to it. You know, Jesus is saying, I don't want you just to be my employee. I don't want you just to do a bunch of stuff for me. It's not what we do for him. It's what we do with him. And you know, Jesus, he might be saying to some of us, where have you been lately? There's mornings I show up, you're not even there. I just want to spend time with you. I want to talk with you like we used to. I'm speaking to myself as much as I'm speaking to you guys. I see this drift in my own heart. I see the pool of so many things pulling me away from love for him. Some of us don't even, we're not even aware you can have this kind of a relationship with God. Love is central to who God is. You can actually have a close love relationship with God that feels every bit as real and maybe even more real than some of the love relationships you've experienced with people. No, he doesn't want you just to be his employee. He wants to warm up that cold heart. He's calling out to you tonight. So what do we do? What can we do when love grows cold? You know, we're heading into winter. When I think winter, I think about this. What an awful sight that is. To have to go out and start chiseling this snow-covered, ice-covered car out of its place. But man, you know, if you can go out there, you can kind of chisel that thing out of there, and you can fire that car up, and that car starts to warm up. It's actually a pretty awesome feeling. Actually, back before I had a garage, which I highly recommend garages, I used to get this little thing installed whenever I get a new car. You could stand at the front window and press a button and the car would start. And the night before, I would make sure the heat is cranked up all the way. And I would just let it go for like way too long, okay? But when I finally get out there, that car was warmer than my house. And it was an awesome feeling. But outside of some sort of like external intervention, this car is not gonna warm up. Like you can't just look within this car for sources of warmth. And too often we do that. When our heart grows cold toward God and toward other people, we look down within and we try to drum up some feelings. Maybe we make ourselves feel guilty that I've left my first love and I don't feel the same things I did at first. That's not what Jesus is saying. And that's not the solution. We don't look deep into our cold, cold hearts to find warmth beneath the ice. No, we look to him. We start thinking about his love for me, what he's done for me on the cross throughout eternity, what he's done to work in my life, all the ways he's answered prayers, all the things he's given me, done for me. And that gratitude, we can thank God for this and this and this and this. There's almost an infinite number of things you'd be thanking God for, no matter how your life's going. You're alive, that's pretty good. You have your eyesight, most of us in this room probably do. What a blind person would not give to have eyesight. And yet God has blessed you with the ability to see, and he's blessed you with so many of your physical faculties, mental faculties, relationships. And then you just think about what Christ did for you, his love for you. And then your love starts to warm up. And this is where Jesus is going to point them next. He doesn't just point out the problem, he points out the solution. Along with this warning, but he points out the solution. He says, remember how far you have fallen. So he wants them to engage their mind. And then he says, turn back to me. That's engaging the will. The word in some of our Bibles is repent, which just means to turn back. And do the works you did at first. So he's engaging the actions, the body. So the mind, the will, the body. He's engaging all of these in their turning back to their first love. And I think we need to adjust our expectations here. You know, the goal of this passage is not for you to feel just as giddy as you were when you first met Christ, any more than the old married couple would feel just as giddy as they were when they were doing those crazy engagement photos. No, this the love that we have, you know, we should not judge that first love. I know I was teasing the engagement photo people, but we should not judge that sincere, you know, expression of love, okay? But don't leave when it feels different. Don't try to drum that back up and don't drift away, because love, anybody who's been in a long-term relationship knows that love has to change. It doesn't stay in that state forever. C.S. Lewis talks about this in Mere Christianity. He's like, look, we couldn't possibly handle it if we stayed in that state forever. It would kill us. You know, what about the rest of your life? You can't sleep. You can't think about anything but your beloved. So he's like, no, it's gonna feel different. You know, my relationship with my wife, the love I have for her does not feel exactly the same that it felt in those early days of dating and engagement. You know, they talk about the honeymoon's over, and like that's a negative thing, and it can be a negative thing. But part of what that's saying is that initial love has to develop into something deeper. And the love that I share with my wife now, it is so much deeper and better than that roller coaster love of those early days. And what happens is you go through stuff together. You suffer together. You experience things together. And that love deepens. And you see, I hurt the other person and they forgive me. And they love me anyway. And you start to see deeper and deeper how negatively you affect people and how selfish you are. And this person loves me anyway. And that's the way it is with God. Stick in there. Watch love deepen as you go through things together. You know, initially, when I first came into like relationships with other Christians, as a Christian, I was just like, I'd never seen this before, and this is so exciting. And then, you know, you've seen it before. And it's maybe not as exciting or novel, but it's still good. And God, part of what God is doing is he's teaching you to love deeper. He's working on aspects of your character to make you a more well-rounded, loving person. He's making you more dependent on him. He's driving you deeper into knowledge of him as you learn to love other people. And so we should be no less passionate about in our love for one another or for God, even though the feelings aren't exactly the same. This is part of the maturing of love. And you ever look at like an old couple that's been married a long time and they're in love, and you see them, and they don't look like those engagement photo couples, but you see something there that you really want, something that's really cool, even cooler, and can only be purchased through decades of sacrifice and hanging in there with one another. And there is a relationship with God that can only be had by decades and suffering and hanging in there and drawing near to him. And when I look at my relationship with God, it's the absolute hardest times in my life. I think about those times and I know God was there with me. I remember sitting down with God during those times. And those are moments I will never, ever forget, when he was there for me in a way that only he could be. And I thank him for those. And our love grows deeper. My love for him grows. His love for me can't get any deeper. And unlike a human relationship, if there's a problem in our relationship, it's always my fault. You know, if you're not close to God, who moved, right? He's there. He says, James says, draw near to God and he will draw near to you. That's a great promise for this passage. So we got to stick in there with him. We got to stick in there with one another, and we got to watch love deepen as we go through suffering together. And like I said, this applies to love for God and to love for people. Let's think about this a little more practically, how this applied to them, how it might apply to us. He says, remember how far you've fallen. So remember, he's engaging the mind. Remember how exciting it used to be to serve God. There was an excitement there. Say, God, give me that excitement again. Maybe the excitement was there because you were taking risks back then, and you're not, the things that were risky back then aren't risky now. Maybe God's pushing you out a little more. Sort of that thrill of, you know, it's, if you've ever been rappelling, there's a moment where you gotta like lean backward and be 90 degrees to the side of the cliff and then start walking backward down. That's a scary moment. There are these moments in serving God that are scary because he's pushing us into new areas. We're not plateauing like so many people do as they get older. Think how your life was before Christ. He points this out to the Ephesians in 2:12. He says, you were without hope and without God in the world. Remember how lonely you were? Remember how great for you were for one friend, and now you're like, oh, I got all these people in my life. It's like, you were such a loser. At least I was. And you would have killed for a single friend. And now you got more than you know what to do with. Who am I that this is my life? The loneliness, the hopelessness, without hope and without God in the world. The despair about what will happen when I die. Now remember that. Think back on that. Think about that sudden switch. Don't ever stop thanking God for that. Think about God's patience with you. Think about the gratitude you've felt for that time and time again. There's times in my life where God has just broken in on me, where it's like, oh my God, I see my sin so clearly. And it's almost overwhelming. And then you're hit with his grace, and what a great feeling that is in. The effort you used to put into relationships. Remember that? Are we still doing that? Are we coasting? Did we click the autopilot button on our relationships? There's no autopilot button on our relationships. There's no cruise control. We have to keep loving, keep giving of ourselves. And if we don't, then we're gonna be like that person in 1 Corinthians 13, the clanging gong. The have nothing, the are nothing. He also says, do the works you did at first. What would that look like when it comes to loving God? Well, you know, we see in Acts 19, the Ephesian believers, they were bringing their occult paraphernalia. Millions of dollars worth they brought to this huge bonfire. They were confessing, I used to look to these other gods. I'm not gonna do that anymore. And I'm gonna burn this. I'm not even gonna resell this to try to get some money for it. I want this to go away. And they're expressing their devotion to God. I'm not gonna put my hope in other things anymore. Are we still doing that? Are there things we need to confess? Are there things we need to admit we're wrong? Is there sacrifice God is calling on you to make? Is your devotion switched to something else and it needs to go back where it belongs? Witnessing to others, it says the word about Christ, the good news about Christ, it sounded out to the whole province of Asia. How you doing on that? Telling people about Christ. It's not just something for new believers. They can often be more enthusiastic about it, but it's exciting when you do this. Are there areas where God is calling on you in this area? What about the area of study? They used to go to that school of Tyrannus and spend all afternoon. This is like break time when it's kind of too hot to do anything else. And they're like, I'm hitting the books. I'm gonna go sit through a lecture from the Apostle Paul. How are we doing on study? Are we pushing ourselves? I feel like God has been kind of challenging me in this area. I thought about things I used to do as a younger believer to study, and I don't do those anymore. What about time with God? he prays for the Ephesians. He says, may you experience the love of Christ, though it's too great to understand fully. He says, your roots, they'll grow down into God's love and keep you strong. I pray that for you tonight. Is this a reality in your life? Are you spending time with God like you used to? Are you growing in this? Some of us, we've never really gotten this going. If you don't, you're never gonna make it. Duty, you know, looking around, social pressure, accountability, accountability can be a good thing. It can't substitute for a personal love relationship with Jesus Christ. This is the fuel for the life lived for God. This is fuel for endurance. And you're missing out. This is a good thing he's praying. Experiencing love, roots growing deep into his love. God wants this for you. He's calling to you. He says, I'll be waiting there for you tomorrow. Show up. Let's talk. Maybe I need to go for a walk with God. Leave all my devices at home. Just talk to him. Thank him. Tell him you love him. What about love for others? What were some of the works you did at first with that? What about prayer and expressing affection for one another? I remember so many times in the first house with other guys, other Christian guys I moved into, we would pray together. There was like encouragement letters being written to one another by grown men. It doesn't just happen. You know, Paul, he calls the Ephesian elders to meet him. He's like, hey guys, I'm gonna be in Miletus, come meet me. And they're like, they drop everything and travel like a half a day to meet up with him. Like that's sacrifice, that's sacrifice, that's prayer for one another. You know, we see them at the end of this talk Paul gives in Acts 20. They pray together and then they just break down crying because Paul tells them, I'm not gonna see you guys anymore. You know, the eagerness to spend time together, that's where they just drop everything and they go to meet up with Paul at this seaport down the way there. Are we eager to spend time together? Are we making time for one another? Are we sacrificing for one another? He calls them to forbear with one another. Be diligent to preserve the unity with one another. Are we avoiding difficult people, annoying people? Or are we moving in there with love? Generosity and encouragement. You see this from the Ephesian church in Acts chapter 18, 27. You know, the generosity of a new believer can be so powerful. They'll give. They don't have much and they give. And then you get a little more sophisticated and you make a little more money and then you're not as generous for some reason. Why is that? The encouragement toward one another, the giving toward one another, extending forgiveness and grace to one another. Remembering how much you've been forgiven enables you to forgive other people. Are we harboring bitterness or are we extending grace? He says, if you don't repent, I'll come and remove your lampstand from its place among the churches. Yeah, if we don't have love, you know, the lampstand, that's our light to the world. And Jesus is like, if you're not loving one another, then what have you got? None of the rest of this is gonna last. If you don't love God and each other, that light's just gonna die. You're not gonna be a light to the whole region around you like you have been. It's like when you don't pay the electric bill and the power just shuts off. Jesus is like, you need to love. That's what's gonna be different. The thing that we do differently, more than anything else, is love. You know, we play cards like non-Christians. We do a lot of things like non-Christians, but love, that's what shines the love of Christ out. And then he calls them to listen. Anyone with ears to hear must listen to the Spirit and understand what he is saying to the churches. Do you have ears to hear what the Spirit is saying tonight? All you need is one single ear to hear. He's saying this to you and he's saying this to us. And finally, the promise. He says, to everyone who's victorious, I will give fruit from the tree of life in the paradise of God, Jesus says. Just think about heaven. Jesus says, we're gonna be hanging out. I'm gonna be passing out fruit from the tree of life. He's like, we got a tree of life in heaven, just like they have one back in Genesis 2. It's like we got that there, and that's gonna be so cool. That's that eternal perspective. And that's what we got. Oh God, thank you so much that you you are love and you love us. Thank you that your love is active and initiative and sacrificial, and you sent your son to die on the cross for us. That's how much you loved us, God. And I pray for those of us here that have never experienced your love in a personal way, I pray that they would not just learn about it, but that they would call out to you and humble themselves and receive your love. I pray for those of us too, Lord, that see that our love has slipped, our love for you, our love for one another. I pray that you'd help them to remember, you'd help them to repent, you'd help them to do the things that they did at first, Lord, as they loved you and one another. And I pray they would experience that deepening of that love out of the early exciting highs that it brings to the deep sense of belonging that still includes plenty of highs, Lord. But it's so much more stable and satisfying. And I thank you that we can feed on that love for the rest of our lives and on into eternity. Amen.